Disc 3.
The next morning, three seals were sighted, and Macklin was sent out with Tom Crean to fetch them. When they returned, Shackleton told Macklin that since the party now had a fair supply of meat, his dogs would not be killed quite yet. Hurley's team, though, was shot. Wild, as usual, was executioner. About 3 p.m, the wind gently eased around to the southwest, and a chill came into the air. Throughout the night, the temperature crept downward, and all the next day the southwest breeze held steady. That night, Shackleton wrote, "This may be the turn in our fortune." The wind came on the next day, a whole gale out of the southwest, with driving snow filling the air and the tents quaking with its violence. They huddled in their sleeping bags, dismally uncomfortable, but radiantly happy. 50 miles an hour, McNeish recorded blissfully, but it is welcome, as long as the tents stand. It howled on into January the 19th, unabated. On the 20th, as the gale continued, a very few of them began to tire of the wet from the wind-driven snow filtering into the tents. But most cheerfully endured the dreadful conditions, happy in the knowledge that they must be making good progress to the north. "One hardly likes to guess what our distance may be," Shackleton wrote. "But tonight is the fourth of this blow, and there are no signs of it abating, so we ought to have made a good distance to the north. Ord, Lees and Worsley are the only pessimistic ones in the camp, but this strong wind even made Lees suggest larger stakes on the strength of our distance." The next day the gale roared on with a few gusts to 70 miles an hour, but twice during the morning the sun broke through the clouds. Worsley was ready with his sextant, and James stood by with his theodolite to catch the angle of the sun. They took their sights, worked out the calculations, and announced the result. "Wonderful, amazing, splendid," Shackleton wrote. "We cannot be much more than 170 miles from Paulet." Everyone greeted the news with cheers. "The wind still continues. We may get another 10 miles out of it. Thank God. Drifting still, all wet in the tents, but no matter. Had Bannock to celebrate north of the circle." The Antarctic Circle now lay nearly a full degree of latitude behind them. The gale eased down the following day, and the sun shone brightly. All hands emerged from their tents, glad to be alive. By evening, the gale had blown itself out, and the wind shifted to the north, but nobody minded. A northerly wind was just what they needed to open up the pack, so that they could take to the boats. The wind continued into the next day, without loosening the pack perceptibly. They waited. The following day, Worsley climbed to the top of a 60-foot berg, a short distance to the southeast. He returned with the news that the floe on which Ocean Camp had stood had apparently been blown closer during the gale, and was now only about 5 miles away. Through the glasses he had seen the old wheelhouse storeroom and the third boat, the Stancomb Wills. "What about open water?" Worsley shook his head. "None," he said, "except a small patch, far to the south." Still, the opening would come. It was bound to. But by the time a week had passed, most of the men were abandoning their hopes. They could see almost no change in the pack. If anything, it was tighter than before, packed together by the force of the winds, perhaps driven against some unknown land to the north or northwest. The sense of immediacy gradually diminished, and the atmosphere in camp settled once more into reluctant resignation. Fortunately, the men were kept fairly well occupied. At their new position, game was abundant, and all hands were busy hunting seals and sledging them into camp. By January the 30th, 8 days after the gale ended, they had laid in a stock of 11 seals. Shackleton decided to send Macklin's and Greenstreet's teams on another trip to Ocean Camp. This time, sledging conditions were considerably better, and the trip took less than 10 hours. The teams returned with some odds and ends of stores, including a quantity of canned herring, 60 pounds of bouillon cubes, and a large amount of tobacco. They also obtained a good number of books, among them several volumes of the Encyclopaedia Britannica, which were especially welcome. Even McNeish, a devout Presbyterian, allowed himself a change from his Bible, which he had repeatedly reread from cover to cover. For the next 2 days, Shackleton carefully observed the movements of the pack, and then he decided that a party of 18, under Wilde, should start out early the next morning to bring up the Stancomb Wills. The news came as a great relief. For some time, many of the men, particularly the seamen, had had strong misgivings about the advisability of trying to crowd the entire party into 2 boats. "I'm very glad," Worsley wrote. "If it comes to boats, we shall be far safer in 3. With only 2, it would be a practical impossibility to bring 28 men alive through a boat voyage of any length." The sledging party was awakened at 1 a.m. the next morning, and after a good heavy breakfast they started off, dragging an empty boat sledge with them. It was an easy journey with so many men, and they arrived 2 hours and 10 minutes later. The party started back for Patience Camp at 6:30 a.m., and while the going was considerably heavier, they made good progress. The Stancomb Wills were safe in camp by 1 o'clock. The trip to Ocean Camp to bring up the Stancomb Wills changed the attitude of many men. Until then, some vestige of anticipation that the pack might open had remained. But they had observed, during the 12-mile round-trip journey to Ocean Camp, that the ice was tighter than ever. The days of wishful thinking were over. There was nothing to do but sit down and wait. Day after day dragged by in a grey, monotonous haze. The temperatures were high and the winds were light. Most of the men would have liked to sleep the time away, but there was a limit to the number of hours a man could spend inside his sleeping bag. Every available time-killing pastime was exploited to the fullest. Each day became so much like the one before that any unusual occurrence, however small, generated enormous interest. On the 5th of March, Greenstreet wrote, "Day passes day with very little or nothing to relieve the monotony. There is practically nothing fresh to read, and nothing to talk about, all topics being absolutely exhausted. The pack around looks very much as it did 4 or 5 months ago, and with the low temperature we've been getting at night, the open patches of water get covered with young ice, which is neither fit to go over nor would allow the passage of the boats. My opinion is that the chances of getting to Paulet Island now are about 1 in 10. Indeed, the chances of reaching Paulet Island did appear more remote each day. It now lay exactly 91 miles away, but it was off to the west-northwest, and their drift had steadied onto a course almost true north. Unless there was a radical change in the northerly movement of the pack, it seemed that they would simply pass Paulet Island by. And there was nothing they could do about it, except to wait, helplessly. Then on March the 9th, they felt the swell, the undeniable, unmistakable rise and fall of the ocean. The men gathered outside their tents and stood in excited little groups, pointing out to one another what was perfectly obvious to everyone, a gentle, lazy movement across the entire surface of the pack. There was no doubt. It was the swell from the open sea. But how far away was it? That was the question. Long speculative discussions were held all day as Worsley crouched by the edge of the flow and continued to time the infinitely slow rise and fall of the ice. By evening, everyone was satisfied that the open ocean lay, at most, 30 miles away. Shackleton alone seemed to sense in the swell a new and far more grave threat than almost any they had faced. He knew there could be no escape if the swells were to increase while the pack remained closed. The action of the sea would then crack and break the floes, ultimately grinding the ice to bits on which they could not camp and through which they could not sail. Before he turned in, Shackleton took one final look around the camp to satisfy himself that the tents and boats were not so close together that their combined weight might in itself crack the floe. A further advantage of this precaution was that while their equipment was spread out over a large area, they were not likely to lose a sizable amount of gear into a crack. The men crawled out of their tents the next morning, expecting to see that the swell had increased. Instead, there wasn't the slightest suggestion of movement in the pack, and the ice was as close as ever. A disappointment, amounting to grief, swept through most of the party. The first real sign of the open sea, the tantalising promise of escape, for which they had waited so long, had been dangled in front of them, then snatched away. That afternoon, Shackleton ordered a drill to see how quickly the boats could be removed from their sledges and loaded with stores in case of an emergency. The men did what they had to do, but the raw edge of their tempers was beginning to show, and there were a number of savage exchanges. Nor were matters improved when the stores were placed in the boats, and everybody could see just how pitifully small their supplies really were. After the drill, the men returned moodily to their tents, hardly speaking to one another. Until the appearance of the swell, many of the men had struggled for months not to let hope creep into their minds. For the most part, they had convinced themselves not only that the party would have to winter on the floes, but even that such a fate would be quite endurable. But then came the swell, the physical proof that there really was something outside this limitless prison of ice. And all the defences they had so carefully constructed to prevent hope from entering their minds collapsed. To make matters worse, the problem of food, especially blubber for cooking, was again approaching the critical point. It was 3 weeks since they had killed a seal, and the meagre store of blubber was almost gone. Their stock of provisions from the ship was also nearly exhausted. On March the 16th, 1916, the last of their flour was used up. It was made into dog pemmican bannocks, and several men nipped and nibbled at their one-ounce portions for more than an hour. Inevitably, the old resentments against Shackleton's refusal to get in all possible game when it was available cropped up. Even Macklin, who had refrained from all criticism of Shackleton's policy in the past, wrote, "I think the boss was a bit improvident in not getting in all the food possible whilst the going was good. It was worth the risk." By March the 22nd, the food situation was so critical that Shackleton told Macklin that his dogs would have to be shot the next day, so that the party might eat the food set aside for the dogs. Macklin reacted indifferently. "I must confess that I cannot see that they will be of much more use to us. Ocean Camp has apparently disappeared. We have now only 10 more days blubber fuel. It is to be hoped that we can get more seals, or we shall be in a bad way indeed." The morning of March the 23rd dawned cold, with a patchy fog lying across the pack. Shackleton was up early to take a constitutional. He walked to the edge of the floe, and when the fog cleared for a moment, he saw a black object, far in the distance to the southwest. He watched it for a few minutes, then hurried back to his tent and roused Hurley. The two men returned to the edge of the floe and peered for several minutes through the intermittent bands of fog. It was there, all right. And it was land. Shackleton immediately ran back to camp, going from tent to tent, shouting, "Land in sight! Land in sight!" The reaction was strange. Some men bounded out of their tents to see for themselves, but others, cold and discouraged, and tired of mistaking distant bergs for land, refused to stir from their sleeping bags, at least until the sighting had been confirmed. But this was not a distant berg or a mirage. It was one of the tiny danger islets, identifiable by its tabletop bluffs rising steeply out of the water. It lay exactly 42 miles away. Only 20 miles beyond it lay what had been their destination, Paulet Island. "If the ice opens, we could land in a day," wrote Hurley. But there wasn't a man among them who believed that the pack would open, quite the contrary. There were fully 70 bergs in sight, and they seemed for the moment to be preventing the pack from either opening or drifting much to the north. If the boats had been launched, they would probably have been crushed within minutes. The sight of land was but another reminder of their helplessness. Greenstreet's attitude was rather typically cynical. "It's nice to think there is something else besides snow and ice in the world, but I fail to see any cause for excitement, as it puts us no nearer getting out. What I would far rather see would be a crowd of seals coming up, so that we might get food and fuel. "Please God," wrote Shackleton that night, "we will soon get ashore." But there was precious little land left on which to get ashore. They had drifted to the absolute tip of the Palma Peninsula, and reaching land there now seemed all but impossible. Thus, between them and the open seas, and Cape Horn rollers of the dreaded Drake Passage, all that remained were two lonely, sentinel-like outposts of the Antarctic continent, Clarence and Elephant Islands, about 120 miles to the north. Beyond these, there was nothing. Less than a week's supply of blubber remained, so on March the 26th, the 5-ounce ration of seal steaks at breakfast was cut out. In its place, the men were usually given a half-pound cake of cold dog pemmican and a half-ration of powdered milk. On very cold days, a few lumps of sugar were added. Lunch was one biscuit and 3 lumps of sugar, and supper, the only so-called hot meal of the day, consisted of seal or penguin hoosh, cooked for the minimum possible time. No water was issued at any time. If a man wanted a drink, he packed snow into a small can, usually a tobacco tin, and held it against his body to melt, or slept with it in his sleeping bag. But a full tobacco tin of snow yielded only a tablespoonful or two of water. Macklin was told to pick out anything fit for human consumption from the stock of waste meat used to feed the dogs. It was a repulsive collection of odd bits of flesh, Macklin noted, and, unfortunately, if we do not get more seals, we will have to eat it raw. It appeared, too, that the dogs would have to be eaten soon. They had been spared thus far because there was still a bare chance of making one last trip to Ocean Camp for the stores there. After that was done, or if it became evident that it could not be done, the dogs were to be shot and eaten. For days, several men had urged Shackleton to risk this one desperate dash back to Ocean Camp, now barely visible about 7 miles away. A 600 or 700 pound store of dog pemmican and about 60 pounds of flour still remained there. But Shackleton, though he was gravely concerned about the state of their supplies, could not bring himself to send the dog drivers across the ice, which was so obviously treacherous. Almost continually, there were sounds of pressure, apparently caused by the ice being jammed against the curving arm of the Palma Peninsula. The trip seemed to be growing less feasible by the hour, and Shackleton knew that it was now or never. Reluctantly, he told Macklin that night to be ready for a possible start early the next morning. Macklin had already turned in, but he was so delighted at the news that he got up and worked for some time, readying the harness and getting his sledge into shape. But at dawn, the ice was very much on the move, and a heavy mist had rolled in. Shackleton came to number 5 tent just at breakfast time to inform Macklin that he had decided against the trip. It was a crushing disappointment. Shackleton had hardly left when Macklin turned on Clark for some feeble reason, and the two men were almost immediately shouting at one another. The tension spread to Audley's and Worsley, and triggered a blasphemous exchange between them. In the midst of it, Greenstreet upset his powdered milk. He whirled on Clark, cursing him for causing the accident. Clark tried to protest, but Greenstreet shouted him down. Then Greenstreet paused to get his breath, and in that instant his anger was spent, and he suddenly fell silent. Everyone else in the tent became quiet too, and looked at Greenstreet, holding his empty mug in his hand, and looking helplessly down into the snow that had thirstily soaked up his precious milk. The loss was so tragic, he seemed almost on the point of weeping. Without speaking, Clark reached out and poured some of his milk into Greenstreet's mug. Then Worsley, then Macklin, and Rickinson, and Kerr, Ord Lees, and finally Blackborough. They finished in silence. Just after breakfast, two seals were sighted, and hunting parties were urgently organised. The first group secured the closer of the two, and the others were within a short distance of their quarry when Shackleton, feeling that the ice was too dangerous, summoned them back to camp. Later in the day, the misty weather turned into pure rain, with the temperature rising to 33 degrees. In the afternoon, the rain changed to snow, and by 5 o'clock it had ceased altogether. James was night watchman that evening from 9 to 10, and as he was walking around the floe, he thought he detected a movement in the ice. Looking closely, he saw a very distinct swell slowly lifting the floe. He reported his discovery to Shackleton, who gave orders that the watchman should be especially alert. At 5:20 the next morning, the floe split. Little Alf Cheetham was on watch, and he dashed among the tents. "Crack!" he shouted. "Crack! Lash up and stow!" Within seconds, all hands had tumbled out of their tents. They saw two cracks, one running the length of the floe, and another extending at right angles to the first. In addition, the whole pack was rising to a very marked swell. They ran to the James Caird and wrenched the frozen runners of her sledge free of the ice, then manhandled her to the centre of the floe. By then, the crack down the centre had widened out to 20 feet in some places and could be seen slowly working back and forth under the influence of the swell. Their store of meat was on the other side. Several men jumped across where the crack was not so wide and pitched the meat over the seam of open water. By 6:45... everything was safely across, and work was halted for breakfast. The men were standing around waiting for their ration when the floe cracked again, this time directly under the James Caird, 100 feet from the tents. No order was needed. The men dashed to the boat and quickly brought her up closer to the tent area. Finally, they were able to eat breakfast. The usual lump of dog pemmican, 6 pieces of sugar, and a half mug of milk. Breakfast was hardly finished when through the mists a strange shape appeared, moving deliberately across a nearby section of their old floe. Wild ran to get his rifle from his tent, then he dropped to one knee and shot. The animal bucked and slowly sank down onto the ice. Several men hurried to where it lay. A sea leopard, nearly 11 feet long. With one bullet, it seemed, Wilde had changed the whole complexion of their lives. There at their feet lay nearly 1,000 pounds of meat and at least 2 weeks' supply of blubber. In high good spirits, the party sent out the dogs to return the trophy to camp. When it was butchered, they found in its stomach nearly 50 undigested fish, which were carefully set aside to be eaten the next day. It was 9 o'clock by the time the job was finished. Shackleton then summoned Macklin and told him the time had come to shoot his dogs. Macklin made no protest, for there was really no longer any reason to spare them. The possibility of reaching open camp was more remote than ever, in view of the new breakup, and now that they had the sea leopard, the need for risking such a trip was past. Accompanied by Wilde, Macklin drove his team across the narrow neck of a crack to where the galley formerly had stood. Macklin was almost sick as he unharnessed one dog at a time and took it around the protective mound of ice. Wilde, as before, sat each dog down in the snow, placed the muzzle of the revolver almost against its head, and pulled the trigger. When all the dogs had been killed, Macklin skinned and gutted the carcasses, preparing them for eating. Crean's team of puppies was also killed and butchered. Back at camp, there was almost a holiday atmosphere in anticipation of the first hot lunch in more than 2 weeks. The suggestion was made that they sample the dog meat, and Shackleton agreed. The meat of the dogs was universally acclaimed. "Their flesh tastes a treat," McNeish remarked, after being so long on seal meat. Throughout the morning, the swell had continued and even increased slightly, so at lunch Shackleton announced that they would immediately go on a watch-and-watch system, 4 hours on and 4 hours off. Shackleton would take charge of one watch and Wilde the other. Thus half the party would be on duty at all times, fully dressed, with their gear lashed and ready to move at a moment's notice. Two of the men on watch would be required to walk the floe continuously, looking for cracks or any other threatened emergency. The others would be permitted to stand by in their tents. During the day, there were more and more signs of an imminent opening. Cape pigeons and terns could be seen overhead, and Worsley sighted a magnificent giant petrel, a definite sign of open water. Clark spied a jellyfish in the crack between two floes, and stated flatly that such creatures were found only in the vicinity of ice-free seas. These, plus a black water sky to the northwest, the presence of the swell, and a high temperature of 34 degrees, led Worsley to remark, "It certainly looks promising." But then he added, "Hope tells a flattering tale." In spite of all the encouraging signs, the pack showed little change throughout the day and into the next morning. That evening, just at 8 o'clock, as Macklin was relieving Audley's on watch, the floe unexpectedly rose to a swell and cracked hardly 2 feet from Wilde's tent. Macklin and Audley's both spread the alarm. But everybody had turned in, confident that there would be no break-up, and the emergency caught them almost totally unprepared. There was a great scramble to get dressed in the pitch-black tents, with everyone trying to find the right clothes and attempting to get into boots that had frozen. Even after the men were out of their tents, there was confusion about exactly what was the trouble and where the danger was. But order was finally restored, the boats were moved closer to the tents, and the stock of meat, which again had been cut off by a crack, was pitched across in the darkness. Throughout the night, the floe lifted very noticeably to the heavy swell, perhaps a foot or more, and the repeated shocks as it bumped against other floes were disconcerting. They all knew that the floe was now so small that should it crack again, something or somebody would almost inevitably fall through and probably be crushed. But when morning came, the southerly wind dropped, and during the forenoon the swell disappeared. At noon, for the first time in 6 days, Worsley obtained a sight. They had drifted an astonishing 28 miles north in 6 days, and this in spite of 5 days of adverse northerly winds. The pack was obviously under the influence of a northerly current. It was April the 3rd, MacLeod's 49th birthday. The party had just toasted his health at lunch when a sea leopard's head appeared at the edge of the floe. MacLeod, who was a small but stocky man, went over and stood flapping his arms to imitate a penguin. The sea leopard apparently was convinced, for he sprang out of the water at MacLeod, who turned and dashed for safety. The sea leopard humped forward once or twice, then stopped, apparently to take stock of the other strange creatures on the floe. The delay was fatal. Wilde had reached into his tent for his rifle. He took deliberate aim and fired, and another 1,000 pounds of meat was added to the larder. Thus the store of provisions was growing steadily. As it did, the morale of the whole party improved accordingly. Though everyone was fully aware that their situation was becoming more critical by the hour, it was much easier to face danger on a reasonably full stomach. Their floe, which had once measured a mile in diameter, was now less than 200 yards across. Most of the time it was surrounded by open water, and it was constantly menaced by swells and collisions with other floes. Clarence Island lay 68 miles due north of them, and though they appeared to be making toward it, they were concerned with the gradual westerly set of their drift, which threatened to increase. If it did, they would be swept out to sea through Loper Channel, the 80-mile-wide gulf between Elephant Island and King George Island. It was impossible to obtain a sight the following day, which was damp and misty, with an unpleasantly heavy swell running. However, on April the 5th, Worsley obtained a position, and it showed that they were headed straight for the open sea. Somehow, in 2 days, their drift had veered to the west and carried them the incredible distance of 21 miles in 48 hours, in spite of head winds. The whole party was stunned by the news. The next day was overcast, so that they were unable to obtain a position, but during the night of April the 6th the sky cleared, and it was still fairly bright at daybreak. Away in the distance, almost due north, an enormous berg was sighted. But as the sun rose higher, they saw that the upper limits of the berg were shrouded in clouds. No berg was that high. It was an island. But which island? From their estimated drift to the northwest, many men thought it was Elephant Island. Others argued that it had to be Clarence. What puzzled them most was that they could see one and not the other, since the two should have been almost equidistant. At noon, Worsley obtained a sight, which removed all doubt that what they had sighted was Clarence Island, 52 miles away. Even more important, the position showed that the westerly set of their drift had been arrested, and that they had gone 8 miles very nearly due north in the past 2 days. An enormous wave of relief passed through the party. Still, the damnable pack would not open. "Pray God we may find a landing here," wrote Matlin, "and so be off this drifting, uncontrollable pack, taking us we know not where, and in spite of any efforts we may attempt to make. But we are in the hands of a higher power, and puny mortals that we are, can do nothing to help ourselves against these colossal forces of nature. If we fail to make a landing, and it is quite likely, I think it might be a good plan to make an effort to get on a berg. Indeed, many of us have talked and wished for this for many weeks now. But, of course, there are other, more weighty opinions." Those opinions belonged to Ernest Shackleton. He was dead set against moving onto a berg unless it became unavoidable. He knew that bergs, though they looked substantial, could become off balance, because of one portion melting faster than another, and might suddenly and unpredictably upend. The next evening, about 6:45, McNeish was writing his diary. "There's been a large swell since yesterday," he recorded, "but it is doing us no harm now, since our floe is broken up so small. It rises and falls with..." He never finished the sentence. There was a heavy thump, and the floe split under the James Caird. Worsley was on watch, and he shouted for help. All hands dashed from their tents and seized the James Caird just as the crack began to widen. The other two boats, which were on the separated portion of the floe, were hurried across. When it was over, the floe was a triangle of ice, whose sides measured roughly 100 by 120 by 90 yards. Not long after midnight, the wind shifted from the west to the southeast and dropped considerably. Almost at once, great pools of open water appeared as the floes drew apart. But it didn't last. By daybreak, the ice had closed again, though the sky to the north grew black as ink. The swell increased, and the men had to brace themselves slightly as they made their way about. Again at breakfast time, the ice mysteriously moved apart again. Small floes became isolated patches of white, floating on the dark, cold surface of the water. But even as the entire party anxiously watched, the pack closed once more. The swell rose higher on all sides, and their floe began to take a serious pounding. Toward mid-morning, for the third time, lanes and pools of open water unaccountably spread through the pack and widened. At 10:30, Shackleton's booming brogue rang out, "Strike the tents and clear the boats!" The men jumped to their tasks. In minutes the tents were struck, and the sleeping bags gathered and stowed in the bows of the boats. Then, one at a time, the boats were pushed on their sledges to the edge of the floe. Crack! Again the floe had split in two, this time exactly through the spot where Shackleton's tent had stood some minutes before. The two halves drew rapidly apart, separating the Stancombe Wills and a large amount of provisions from the rest of the party. Almost everyone leapt over the widening breach and shoved the cutter and the stores across. Then they waited. Torn between the overpowering desire to launch the boats regardless of the risk, and certain knowledge that once they did so, there could be no turning back. Small as it was, theirs was the only decent floe in sight. If they abandoned it, and the pack closed up before they reached another campsite, there would be no escape. At 12:40, Shackleton gave the order in a quiet voice. "Launch the boats." The floe came alive with activity. The Dudley Docker was removed from its sledge and eased into the water. She was loaded with cases of rations, a bag of meat, the blubber stove, and Number 5's rattly old hoop tent. Next, the Stancombe Wills was rapidly launched and loaded, and finally the James Caird. It was 1:30 in the afternoon when the crew scrambled on board each boat. They put out every available oar and puffed with all their strength for the open water. Even as they drew away from Patience Camp, the ice began to close. The James Caird was in the lead, with Shackleton at the tiller. So far as the ice permitted, he set a course for the northwest. Next came Worsley, steering the Dudley Docker, then Hudson in the Stancomb Wills. With each stroke, the oarsmen fell more into the rhythm of their task. In 15 minutes, Patience Camp was lost in the confusion of ice astern. But Patience Camp no longer mattered. That soot-blackened floe, which had been their prison for nearly 4 months, belonged now to the past. They were in the boats, and that was all that mattered. The boats in which the party set sail upon this forbidding sea were sturdy enough, but no open boat was really equal to the voyage they faced. The Dudley Docker and the Stancomb Wills were cutters, heavy, square-sterned boats of solid oak. They were 21 feet 9 inches long, with a 6-foot 2-inch beam, and they had 3 seats, or thwarts, plus a small decking in the bow and in the stern. They also mounted stubby masts to which a sail could be secured, but they were primarily pulling boats, designed for rowing, not sailing. The only real difference between the two was that McNeish had added planks to the Dudley Docker, which raised her sides about 8 inches. The James Caird was a double-ended whaleboat, 22 feet 6 inches long and 6 feet 3 inches wide. She had been built in England to Worsley's specifications of Baltic pine planking over a framework of American elm and English oak. Though she was somewhat larger than the other two, she was a lighter, springier boat because of the materials of which she was built. McNeish had raised her sides about 15 inches, so that even fully loaded she rose a little more than 2 feet out of the water. The Caird was thus by far the most seaworthy of the three. The Wills carried 8 men, the Docker 9, and the Caird 11. In less stormy waters, with less bulky gear, each might have accommodated at least twice that number. As matters stood, the boats were uncomfortably crowded. The hoop tents and the rolled-up sleeping bags took up a disproportionate amount of room. There were also cases of stores and a considerable amount of personal gear, all of which left scarcely enough space for the men themselves. Throughout the afternoon, as they held to a northwesterly course, the 3 boats made excellent progress. There were belts of ice that were fairly thick, but none so dense as to block their way. Shortly after 5 o'clock, the light began to fail. Shackleton called to the other boats to stay close by until a suitable camping place was found. They rowed until about 5:30, when they came to a flat, heavy floe some 200 yards across, which Shackleton decided was sturdy enough to camp on. Nearly a half dozen approaches were made in the surging swell before the boats were safely hauled onto the ice. It was 6:15 by the time the landing was completed. Green set up his blubber stove while the remainder of the party pitched the tents. Supper was finished by 8 o'clock, and all hands except the watch turned in. It had been a tiring but exciting day. By Worsley's estimate, they had made a good 7 miles to the northwest. Though the distance itself was not impressive, the fact that they had finally taken to the boats was the fulfilment of a dream. After 5.5 months on the ice, they were under way at last. They dropped off to sleep almost immediately. Toward 11 o'clock, Shackleton became strangely uneasy, so he dressed and went outside. He noticed that the swell had increased, and their floe had swung around so that it was meeting the seas head-on. He had stood watching for only a few moments when there was a deep-throated thud, and the floe split beneath his feet, and directly under number 4 tent in which the 8 forecastle hands were sleeping. Almost instantly the 2 pieces of the floe drew apart, the tent collapsed, and there was a splash. The crewmen scrambled out from under the limp canvas. "Somebody's missing!" one man shouted. Shackleton saw a shapeless form wriggling in the water, a man in his sleeping bag. Shackleton reached down for the bag, and with one tremendous heave, he pulled it out of the water. A moment later, the 2 halves of the broken floe came together with a violent shock. The man in the sleeping bag turned out to be Ernie Holness, one of the firemen. He was soaked through, but he was alive, and there was no time to worry about him then, because the crack was opening once more, cutting off the occupants of Shackleton's tent and the men who'd been sleeping in the caird from the rest of the party. A line was pitched across, and the two little groups of men, pulling toward one another, managed to bring the halves together once more. The caird was hurriedly shoved across, and then the men leapt to the larger floe. Shackleton waited until the others were safe, but by the time it was his turn, the pieces had drifted apart again. Within 90 seconds he had disappeared into the darkness. For what seemed a very long interval, no one spoke. Then from the darkness they heard Shackleton's voice. "Launch a boat!" he called. Wilde had just given the order. The Wills were slid into the water, and a half-dozen volunteers scrambled on board. They put out their oars and rowed towards Shackleton's voice. Finally they saw his outline in the darkness, and they pulled up alongside his floe. He jumped into the Wills, and they returned to the campsite. Sleep, now, was out of the question. Shackleton ordered the blubber stove lighted, then he turned his attention to Holness, who was shivering uncontrollably in his soaked clothes. But there weren't any dry garments to give him, because their only clothes were the ones they were wearing. To prevent Holness from freezing, Shackleton ordered that he be kept moving until his own clothes dried. For the rest of the night, the men took turns walking up and down with him. His companions could hear the crackling of his frozen garments and the tinkle of the ice crystals that fell from him. Though he made no complaint about his clothes, Holness grumbled for hours over the fact that he had lost his tobacco in the water. At 5 a.m, the first hint of a brightening sky marked the ending of the night. It was April the 10th. After breakfast, everything was made ready for a quick start. Shackleton decided to lighten the boats by abandoning some ice tools and several cases of dried vegetables. Shortly before 8 o'clock, the pack began to loosen, and at 8:10, Shackleton gave the order to launch the boats. The sea was broken by a nasty chop which made the boats lurch heavily, and rowing extremely difficult. But before long, the ice began to open up, and within an hour or so, they found themselves in a vast expanse of ice-free water, so broad they could hardly see the pack to either side. It was a welcome sight after more than a year of looking at nothing but ice. Shackleton had the word passed to hoist sail. The boats were hardly fit sailing companions, and this fact immediately became apparent when the sails were set. The caird caught the wind and heeled to port, drawing steadily ahead of the other two boats. Though the docker was somewhat faster than the Wills, the difference was slight, and neither boat could sail into the wind. There was nothing for the caird to do but to hang back so as not to outdistance the others. Early in the afternoon, the wind increased considerably, and the boats began to take on water at a dangerous rate. For more than an hour, Shackleton kept to a northeasterly course, hoping that the boats would somehow prove equal to the seas. But toward 2 o'clock, he realized that it was foolhardy to press on. The boats came about and proceeded westward, looking for a floe to which they might make fast. The largest single piece of ice they could find was what Worsley described as a floe berg, a thick mass of dark blue pressure ice about 35 yards square, which rose in some places to a height of 15 feet above the water. The perils of the sleepless night before were still altogether too vivid in Shackleton's memory to risk again. The party would have to spend the night in the boats. They pulled up alongside the floe berg and drove oars into the ice. Then they made the bowlines of the boats fast to the oars, and the boats lay off to wait for darkness. Within minutes, however, the wind freshened out of the northeast, and the sea picked up. The boats began to bump heavily against one another, and they threatened to uproot the oars which held them to the floe. In addition, the wind swirled across the surface of the berg, catching snow from its surface and hurling it straight into their faces. After about half an hour of this misery, Shackleton had no choice. If the men were to sleep, there was no alternative to camping on the ice. Reluctantly, he gave the order. The boats were manoeuvred alongside the floe berg, and about half the party scrambled onto the ice. The stores and equipment were quickly passed up, Then came the ordeal with the boats. The edge of the Floeberg was steep and treacherous, rising an almost perpendicular 5 feet out of the water. Thus the boats had to be hauled almost straight up, while the men pulled from a safe distance back from the edge. After a supper of cold dog pemmican, milk and 2 lumps of sugar, they wriggled, fully dressed, into their sleeping bags. A few men, before they closed their eyes, put forth one last bit of effort to record the day's events briefly in their diaries. Hurley recorded the one thought that was uppermost in all their minds. Pray God this floe will remain entire throughout the night. By some minor miracle, it did. But long before dawn, they became aware that something was seriously wrong. At sunrise, they awakened to a terrifying spectacle of nature. During the night, the wind had risen almost a gale force, and from somewhere to the northeast, great quantities of pack had drifted down on them. Now it extended, unbroken, to the horizon in every direction. Berg fragments and shattered floes obliterated the surface of the water. Because of its size, their berg was drifting more slowly than the rest of the pack, which bore down upon it and pounded it on every side, while the surge of the swell was undermining it by eating away at the waterline. Periodically, decayed chunks dropped away from one side or another, and others were torn loose by floe fragments hurled against the berg by the seas. At each impact, the berg shuddered sickeningly. This was precisely the situation Shackleton had feared. The berg was crumbling beneath them, and might split or upend at any moment. And yet to launch the boats would have been idiocy. They would have been splintered to bits in 90 seconds. The whole scene had a kind of horrifying fascination. The men stood by, tense, and altogether aware that in the next instant they might be flung into the sea to be crushed or drowned. And yet the grandeur of the spectacle before them was undeniable. Shackleton climbed to a knoll 12 feet high at one end of the berg, from which he could see the limitless expanse of ice. Here and there, far away, a black line or a small dark patch revealed a lead or a pool of open water. The party's only hope was that one of these openings would drift down and surround the berg, making possible their escape. But time and time again, a lead would approach to within a short distance, then veer to one side or another, or vanish altogether as the ice closed up. Hour after hour they waited, 8, 9, 10 o'clock. Since dawn the boats had been ready, and the stores and equipment lay close by for immediate loading. While they waited, the berg was being systematically destroyed, piece by piece. Late in the morning, a huge sea burst against it, and a 20-foot section slipped into the water, leaving a half-submerged shelf of ice behind. By 1 o'clock, a sickening thought had begun to spread through the party. What if darkness came, and the ice was still tight? With the beating it was taking, the berg could not possibly last until the next morning. They would be pitched into the sea during the night. Shortly before 2 o'clock, there was an excited shout. A pool was opening up. The ice was mysteriously drawing away, as if under the influence of some invisible force. "Launch the boats!" Shackleton cried. Anxious hands seized the boats and hurried them to the edge of the berg. The surface of the sea was 5 feet beneath them, so the men almost pitched the boats off the ice into the water. Crewmen dropped into them, and the stores were hurried on board. In 5 minutes, the boats were away. Until now, the destination had been either Clarence or Elephant Island, whichever the party happened to strike. These were the closest bits of land. At the time the boats were launched from Patience Camp, Clarence Island lay just 39 miles, almost due north. By sailing northwest, they had reduced that distance to about 25 miles north-northeast. However, the greatest quantities of open water now extended to the southwest, toward King George Island, 80-odd miles away. Shackleton made the decision on the spot. They would abandon the effort to reach Clarence or Elephant Island and take advantage of the following wind to make for King George Island. They held to a southwest course throughout the afternoon. As darkness approached, The boats took in their sails and proceeded under oars. In the last glimmer of light, they found a floe and drew alongside it. But there was to be no camping this night, nor ever again so far as Shackleton was concerned. They had learned their lesson twice over, and they were through with the ice for good. The only man to debark now was Green, who carried his blubber stove and supplies onto the floe. He brewed up some seal hoosh and warmed some milk. The men ate, sitting in the boats. When they had finished, they cast off. The boats were made fast, one behind the other, with the docker in the lead. Then the party began to row, very slowly, toward the southwest. They took spells at the oars, two men pulling at a time. The period at the oars was kept short, so that each man had a turn as often as possible. It was the only way to keep warm. Those who were not rowing or on lookout did what they could to keep their blood moving, but sleep was out of the question, for there was nowhere to lie down. The bottom of each boat was so packed with stores that there was scarcely room for the men's feet. Sleeping bags and tents took up most of the space in the bows, and the two thwarts on which the oarsmen sat had to be kept free. That left only a small space midships for the off-duty men to sit, in a tight little group, huddled together for warmth. Toward 5 o'clock, the sky began to brighten. Before long, the dawn of April the 12th broke in radiant splendour along the horizon. They rowed alongside a large floe, and Green jumped ashore to prepare some seal hoosh and hot milk. After breakfast, they cast off and set sail to the southwest under perfect conditions, wide stretches of open water, protected by a line of pack on which hundreds of seals lay sleeping. About 10:30, Worsley took out his sextant. Then, bracing himself against the mast of the docker, he carefully took his sight, the first since leaving Patience Camp. At noon he repeated the procedure, as the boats lay to, awaiting the result. Every face was turned toward Worsley, as he sat in the bottom of the docker, working out his figures. Gradually, a puzzled look came over his face. He checked his calculations over. Then he slowly raised his head. Shackleton had brought the cairn alongside the docker, and Worsley showed him the position. They were 124 miles nearly due east of King George Island, and 61 miles southeast of Clarence Island, 22 miles farther from land than when they had launched the boats from Patience Camp 3 days before. The news was so heartbreaking some men refused to believe it. It couldn't be. Worsley had made a mistake. But no. Some unknown and undetectable easterly current had caught them, a current of such tremendous strength that it had driven them backward into the teeth of a gale. To reach King George Island would mean sailing directly into that current. So, for the third time, Shackleton announced that the destination had been changed. This time it became Hope Bay, about 130 miles away at the tip of the Palmer Peninsula. The boats were set on a southerly course, and the men sat in almost absolute silence, their hopes for an early landing completely shattered. Late in the afternoon, the wind increased, and the boats came upon some scattered ice which Shackleton thought might prove troublesome in the dark. He gave the order to heave to. They tried to find a floe they could tie up to for the night, but there was none, not even a piece large enough to accommodate Green and his stove. The best they could find was a small floe, to which the docker was made fast, with the wheels behind her and the cared last. Even this was difficult in the heavy swell which made both the boats and the floe pitch violently. About 9 o'clock the wind suddenly veered around to the southwest. Immediately the floe ceased to provide a shelter and became instead a windward shore. The boats were being driven towards its jagged edge. Shackleton shouted to get away, and the oarsmen hurriedly got into position. They pulled frantically, until at last they were clear of the floe. For the second night running, there was no sleep, though a few men snuggled together in hopes of generating enough warmth to drop off for a moment. But it was achingly cold. The clothes the men wore, now that they were sitting almost motionless, froze stiff. If a man shifted his position, even slightly, his skin came in contact with a new, unwarmed surface of his clothing. Everyone tried to sit still, but it could not be done. the weariness, the lack of food, the exertion, and the worry had weakened them so that the harder they tried to sit still, the more they shivered, and their own shivering kept them awake. Shackleton doubted that some men would survive the night. 100 times, it seemed, Worsley was asked what time it was. Each time, he reached under his shirt and took out the chronometer he carried slung around his neck to keep it warm. Holding it up close to his face, he read its hands in the feeble light of the moon. It became a kind of gruesome game, seeing who could hold out the longest before asking again what time it was. When finally somebody succumbed to the temptation, every head rose to await Worsley's answer. But the dawn did come, at last. And in its light, the strain of the long dark hours showed on every face. Cheeks were drained and white, eyes were bloodshot from the salt spray, matted beards had caught the snow and frozen into a mass of white. Shackleton searched their faces for an answer to the question that troubled him most. How much more could they take? Some men looked on the point of breaking, while others showed an unmistakable determination to hold out. At least, all of them had survived the night. Shortly after sunrise, the wind swung around to the southeast and freshened considerably. Shackleton called to Worsley to bring the docker alongside the Caird. After a hurried conference, they announced that, for the fourth time, the destination was changed. In view of the southeast wind, they would run for Elephant Island once more, now 100 miles to the northwest, and pray God the wind held fair till they arrived. The boats set off, with the Caird in the lead. They worked their way through the floes, and the men took turns leaning over the bows, trying to fend off the ice. The Primus stoves were lighted, and a ration of hot milk was prepared. In addition, Shackleton said that all hands could eat all they wanted to make up for the cold and lack of sleep. It offered no enticement for some men, to whom seasickness was an additional misery. Ord Lees was worst off, or at least he complained the most, but there was little sympathy for him. He had done less than the others ever since they had taken to the boats. Often, when it came to his turn to row, he pleaded with Worsley to let him off, claiming that he was sick, or that he didn't know how to row well enough. As usual, Worsley found it difficult to be stern, and since there were always plenty of volunteer oarsmen wanting to get warm, Ord Lees was frequently allowed to skip his turn. When Shackleton gave the order that unlimited food would be permitted, the men in the docker taunted Ord Lees by making sure he saw them eating their fill, in the hope that it would sicken him further. Toward 11 o'clock, the scattered pack began to thin out. The wind was increasing. By late morning, it had risen almost to gale force and was driving the boats along at a remarkable clip. Just before noon, they burst from the pack into the open sea. The change was breathtaking. It was as if they had suddenly emerged into infinity. They had an ocean to themselves, a desolate, hostile vastness. They made a pitiable sight. 3 little boats, packed with the odd remnants of what had once been a proud expedition, bearing 28 suffering men in one final, almost ludicrous bid for survival. But this time, there was to be no turning back, and they all knew it. By mid-afternoon, the wind had risen even more, so Shackleton ordered a second reef taken in the sails, and they proceeded this way until dusk. At sunset, Worsley drew the docker alongside the Caird and urged that they continue, but Shackleton flatly refused. It was difficult enough to keep the boats together in daylight. At night, it would be impossible. Shackleton was convinced that their best chance of reaching safety was to remain together. Both the Caird and the Wills were largely dependent on Worsley's skill as a navigator, and Shackleton was acutely aware that the Wills needed constant looking after. Not only was she the least seaworthy of the 3 boats, but Hudson, who was commanding her, was obviously weakening both physically and mentally. Shackleton was certain the Wills would be lost if she got separated from the others. He decided that the 3 boats would spend the night hove to. He ordered the docker to rig a sea anchor, and the Caird made fast to the docker's stern with the Wills behind her. Working with stiffening fingers, Worsley, Greenstreet and MacLeod lashed 3 oars together and stretched a piece of canvas across them. The contrivance was then made fast to a long piece of line and thrown over the side. They hoped the sea anchor would act as a brake, holding the bows of the boats up into the wind as it was dragged through the water. When it was in position, the crews of all three boats settled down to wait for morning. Never was there a worse night. As the darkness deepened, the wind increased, and the temperature dropped ever lower. It was so cold that the seas that broke over them froze almost as soon as they hit. The boats, the men, everything was soaked, then frozen. On the Caird, they managed to make enough room for four men to huddle together at one time in the pile of sleeping bags in the bow, and they took turns trying in vain to sleep. On the Docker, however, there was only room enough for the men to sit upright, huddled together, with their feet squeezed between the cases of stores. The seas that came on board ran down into the bottom of the boat. They did what they could to keep the boats bailed dry, but the water sometimes rose ankle-deep. To keep their feet from freezing, they worked their toes constantly inside their boots. By far the worst off was the Wills. The water she was shipping was sometimes almost knee-deep. Blackborough, who had insisted on wearing leather boots to save his felt pair for what he thought would be the future, lost all feeling in his feet after several hours, and Hudson, who had been at the tiller for almost 72 hours straight, developed a pain in his left buttock, which became increasingly intense as the part began to swell. After a time, he had to sit hunched sideways, and the rolling of the boat was agony to him. He was also suffering from severe frostbite in his hands. All the boats were thick with ice, but the Wills was weighted down like a log. The seas poured on board her, flowing over the pile of sleeping bags in the bow and leaving them sheathed in ice. Ice formed in masses around her bow as she dipped into each sea, weighting her down that much more, so that every half hour or so men had to be sent forward to beat the ice off her bow, lest she go under. Toward 3 a.m., the wind began to fall, and by 5 o'clock it had dropped to a gentle breeze. Gradually the sea grew calmer. The sky was clear, and finally the sun rose in unforgettable brilliance through a pink mist along the horizon. As the sun climbed a fraction higher, they saw, off the starboard bow, the peaks of Clarence Island, and a little later Elephant Island, dead ahead, the promised land, no more than 30 miles away. In the joy of that moment, Shackleton called to Worsley to congratulate him on his navigation, and Worsley, stiff with cold, looked away in proud embarrassment. They would land by nightfall, provided that not a moment was lost. Shackleton, impatient to be on the move, gave the order to get under way immediately, but it was not that simple. Both the Docker and the Wills were severely iced up inside and out. It took more than an hour to chip away enough to make them fit for sailing. The boats were finally under way at 7 o'clock. The sails were set, and they put out the oars and rowed at the same time, aiming for the west edge of Elephant Island to offset the gentle southwest wind that was blowing. Hour after hour, they rowed, and the outline of Elephant Island slowly grew larger. At noon, they'd covered almost half the distance. By 1:30, they were less than 15 miles away. They'd had no sleep for almost 80 hours, and their bodies had been drained by exposure and effort of almost the last vestige of vitality. But the conviction that they had to land by nightfall gave rise to a strength born of desperation. By 2 p.m., the snowy 3,500-foot peaks of Elephant Island rose steeply out of the water, dead ahead, probably no more than 10 miles off. But an hour later, the island was still in the same position, hanging there, no closer, and yet no farther away. Row as they might, they were standing still, apparently caught in a strong tidal current, setting offshore. The wind had shifted to the north, so that they were also bucking a headwind, and the sails had to be lowered. Worsley brought the Docker alongside the Caird. Screaming to make himself heard above the wind, he told Shackleton he thought it would be best if the boats separated to try to make land independently along the southeast shore of Elephant Island. Shackleton granted Worsley permission to proceed independently. The Wills, however, was kept fast astern of the Caird, and Shackleton admonished Worsley to do everything in his power to stay within sight. It was dark by the time the docker cast off. The island was close, but just how close was now impossible to tell. High in the sky was a ghostly, pale, white image, the light of the moon shining through the clouds and reflecting back up from the glaciers on the island. It was all they had to steer by as the boats pounded forward into the cross sea. Their immediate goal was the southeast corner of the island. Once around that, they would have the protection of the land, then they could look for a place to beach the boats. About midnight, Shackleton glanced to starboard and saw that the docker was gone. He jumped to his feet and peered intently across the stormy waters. But there was no sign of her. Anxiously, he ordered the candle in the compass binnacle lighted, and then had the binnacle hoisted up the mast so that it shone on the Caird's sail, but no answering light appeared in the distance. Shackleton called for a box of matches. He instructed Hussey to light one every few minutes and hold it so that it flared against the sail. One at a time, Hussey struck the matches as Shackleton peered into the darkness. Still, there was no signal from the docker. But she tried to answer. She was hardly more than half a mile away, and her men had seen the Caird signal in the dark. On Worsley's instructions, they took their only candle under the tent cloth and lighted it. Then they tried to hold it so that its light would show through the canvas in reply to Shackleton's signal. But the reply was never seen. A moment later, all thought of trying to signal the Caird was forgotten as the docker suddenly lurched violently in the grip of a fierce tide rip. Worsley was barely able to keep control of the boat. The crew hurriedly took in the sail and even unstepped the mast, which threatened to snap off in the wildly pitching boat. They put out the oars and tried to hold her steady by rowing. Worsley ordered Audley's to take up an oar, but Audley's begged to be let off. The two men screamed at one another in the darkness, and from every corner of the boat, men cursed Audley's. But it was no use, and finally, Worsley disgustedly waved him forward. Audley's immediately crawled into the bottom and refused to move, even though his weight unbalanced the boat. After a time, Worsley decided to risk hoisting sail again. He swung the docker into the teeth of the wind, holding her as close to it as she would go, so that they were taking the seas more or less head-on. He put all the skill of 28 years at sea into holding her in that delicate position, but she was very nearly uncontrollable. Furthermore, she was becoming sluggish under her increasing burden of water. Audley's, who had been lying in the bottom, sat upright. He seemed suddenly to realise that the boat was sinking, and he grabbed a pot and began to bail. Cheetham joined him, and together they worked furiously, hurling the water over the side. In time, the docker rose again to the seas. It was now about 3 o'clock, and Worsley himself began to fail. He had faced the wind so long that his eyes refused to function properly, and he found it impossible to judge distance. Try as he might, he could no longer stay awake. They had been in the boats now for 5.5 days, and during that time almost everyone had come to look upon Worsley in a new light. In the past he'd been thought of as excitable and wild, even irresponsible. But all that was changed now. During these past days he had exhibited an almost phenomenal ability, both as a navigator and in the demanding skill of handling a small boat. There wasn't another man in the party even comparable with him, and he had assumed an entirely new stature because of it. Now, seated at the tiller, his head began to nod. Macklin offered to take over. Worsley agreed, but when he tried to go forward, he found he could not straighten out his body. He had sat for almost 6 days in the same position. MacLeod and Marston pulled him out of the stern, dragging him over the seats and cases of stores. Then they laid him down in the bottom of the boat and rubbed his thighs and stomach until his muscles began to loosen. But by then he was asleep. Greenstreet, too, had taken a moment's exhausted rest, but now he awoke and took over the tiller from Macklin. Neither of them had any idea where they might be, but they shared the same dread as everybody else, the open sea. Between Elephant and Clarence Islands there is a gap about 14 miles wide, beyond which lies the Drake Passage. The last time the boats had been sure of their position was at dusk, when Elephant Island lay only about 10 miles away. But since then, the wind had been out of the southwest, straight toward that fateful gap. If they were blown through, the chances of beating back to windward toward the island would be virtually non-existent. The palest hint of light showed in the eastern sky and began to brighten, very slowly. Gradually, the surface of the sea became discernible. And there, dead ahead, were the enormous grey-brown cliffs of Elephant Island, rising out of the mists high above the boat. The distance seemed no more than a few hundred yards. There was no great joy in that moment, only a feeling of astonishment, which soon gave way to a sense of tremendous relief. Just then, without an instant's warning, offshore gusts of wind swept down off the cliffs, striking the surface of the sea at perhaps 100 miles an hour. A moment later, a wall of water, as high as the boat, rolled toward the docker. Greenstreet shouted to drop the sail. The oars were hurriedly put out, and they pulled head-on into the blasts that shrieked down off the mountaintops. Somehow, they managed to hold the docker's head up into it, but the exertion required them to put forth strength they no longer really had. Looking forward, they saw a new wave, possibly 6 feet high, bearing down upon them. Somebody shouted to wake up Worsley, and MacLeod shook him violently, trying to rouse him. When Worsley failed to stir, MacLeod kicked him again and again. Finally, Worsley opened his eyes. He sat up, and instantly he realized what was happening. "For God's sake," he shouted, "get her around! Get away from it! Hoist the sail!" The men struggled feverishly to raise the sail. She had just caught the wind when the first wave hit them and rolled over the stern. Greenstreet was almost knocked off his seat. A moment later, the second wave engulfed them. The docker, half filled with water, slumped under the burden. The men seized the first thing that came to hand and began to bail. They threw the water over the side with mugs, hats, even their cupped bare hands. Gradually, they got the docker emptied out. Worsley took the tiller and turned north to run before the gale, with the seas pursuing the boat from astern. He guided her close inshore, just under the lofty glaciers fringing the island. Pieces of ice floated amongst the waves, and the men leaned over the sides as the boat drove past and scooped them up with their hands. A moment later they were chewing and sucking greedily, and the delicious water was running down their throats. Throughout the night, Shackleton, on board the Caird, had kept watch for the docker, and as the hours passed, his anxiety mounted. He had faith in Worsley's seamanship, but such a night demanded something more than skill. However, there was more than enough to keep him occupied with the Caird. Wilde remained at the tiller, and as the southwest gale increased, he held them on a course as nearly into the wind as possible, so that they wouldn't be blown past the island. Spray burst over the bow and swept across the dark forms of the men huddled in the bottom of the boat. On board the Wills, conditions were even more miserable. The pain in Hudson's side had become almost intolerable, and it was more than he could bear to stay at the tiller. Rickenson, a slight individual, seemed on the point of collapse and sat by himself off to one side. Howe and Stevenson, when they weren't bailing, clung to one another, seeking to generate some bit of warmth between their bodies. Blackborough's feet were long since beyond the point of hurting. He never complained, though he knew that it was only a matter of time until gangrene set in. Even if he lived, it seemed unlikely that this youngster, who had stowed away a year and a half before, would ever walk again. Once during the night, Shackleton called to him in an attempt to raise his spirits. "Blackborough," he shouted in the darkness, "we shall be on Elephant Island tomorrow. No one has ever landed there before, and you will be the first ashore." Blackborough did not answer. Shackleton sat in the stern of the Caird alongside Wilde, with his hand on the line between them and the Wills. Before dark he had instructed Hudson that if the Wills got adrift he was to make for land leeward, probably Clarence Island, and wait there until a rescue boat could be sent to pick up the men. But the order had been merely a routine pretense. Shackleton knew that if the Wills broke loose, she would never be seen again.
End of Disc 3.